Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Nursing Home Residents Safety Act campaign kicked off yesterday, calling for more nursing aides and better quality patient care.
We will have a live interview with the executive director of Oregon Tradeswomen, an organization that trains women in construction fields.
And presidential deputy chief of staff Carl Rove testified again before the grand jury today.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,391 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 38,660 civilians have been reportedly killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 26, 2006. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Oregonians without health insurance are more likely to go without necessary medical care than residents in nearly any other state, according to a new study. More than half of uninsured Oregonians, 56%, say they cannot afford a visit to the doctor when they need it. That was the second highest percentage of uninsured people reported to be going without care in the country, closely following West Virginia. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a private healthcare research organization, analyzed 2004 government data to make the findings, which were released today in anticipation of Cover the Uninsured Week in May. The event is a national campaign to raise awareness of the problems of the uninsured. U.S. Census figures show that 591,000 Oregonians are without health insurance. Many of these people are skipping necessary preventative care, according to the Foundation's study. For example, 62% of women ages 40 to 64 have not had a mammogram in the past 2 years. Previous studies indicate unemployment, federal Medicaid cuts, and a shrinking Oregon health plan have contributed to Oregon's high level of uninsured.
Governor Ted Kulongowski arrived at Roosevelt Elementary in Medford yesterday to sign a bill allocating $42.2 million to Oregon schools. The signing was an unexpected bonus for Oregon's 198 public school districts, as well as an important learning experience for young students. Tuesday's signing of House Bill 3510 will help make a dent in Oregon's struggling school budgets, but it's still not the cure all have many have been hoping for. It's been a good year for the Oregon Lottery, and that success is now helping out Oregon schools when they need it the most. The governor also highlighted his Education Enterprise Plan, which provides a long-term strategy to stabilize education funding. The Education Enterprise would guarantee successive budget increases for every part of the education system of at least 10% each biennium and create an education investment fund. Under the Education Enterprise, and if the legislator approves the governor's education budget of $6 billion for K-12 for the 2007-2009 school years, Oregon will rise above the national average for per-student spending by the end of the 2007-2009 biennium, and with a guaranteed 10% increase would enable the K-12 budget for 2009-2011 to grow to more than $7 billion.
Michael Brown, the former director of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is being hired by a Portland company. KBOO's Spencer Raymond reports on how the company is happy to have Brown on board.
On-Screen Technologies Incorporated, a Portland company that makes compact displays for emergency first responders, hired Michael Brown about 2 weeks ago, but it wasn't made public until this week. Brown, the embattled ex-Federal Emergency Management Agency chief, was hired by OnScreen, an 8-year-old company that relocated from Florida to Portland last fall. Linda Ferguson at OnScreen said they actively pursued Brown because of the experience he has.
OnScreen basically went after Michael consciously due to the fact that our office in Florida had witnessed the success of the previous year, his ability to manage 4 catastrophic hurricanes in Florida. And we felt that the product we had for first responders called Ready Alert is a product that we believed would be of immense support for first responders who are trying to evacuate for hurricanes. And so we knew Michael had a lot of great experience and understanding of hurricanes and disasters in general, and that he could help us with understanding who to target within government agencies and emergency management agencies. So that was really why we wanted to get his input and consulting experience.
OnScreen makes Ready Alert, a system of portable computerized signs that first responders can use to instantly direct traffic or display messages to the public about safety concerns in remote locations. Brown resigned from his FEMA job last year in the face of criticism over the agency's sluggish response to Hurricane Katrina. But Ferguson said the response Brown received at the National Hurricane Conference solidified the hire.
It definitely was something we thought about, but quite frankly, we took him to the National Hurricane Conference 2 weeks ago, and he had an amazing response.
OnScreen CEO and President Charlie Baker told the Associated Press that Brown's background and expertise in disaster planning and his understanding of first responder needs makes him a perfect addition to the OnScreen strategic team. Brown signed a 2-year contract calling for him to devote 50 to 75% of his time to OnScreen, helping it strategize about uses for its products and potential customers. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
A local effort to address stigmas and discrimination against those who are mentally ill kicks off this week in Portland. KBOO's Denise Kowalczyk has more.
10 years ago, the World Psychiatric Association launched an effort to battle the stigma and discrimination associated with schizophrenia. A program was created on an international scale to change the perception surrounding the disease. Locally, a campaign based on some components of the WPA's program will be launched this week. One of the program directors involved with that campaign is Professor Patricia Backler of the Bioethics Department of Portland State University. According to Professor Backler, about 1% of the population is diagnosed with schizophrenia, and there are various reasons why stigmas are applied to the disease. She says it's important to consider the perspective.
I think that the usual issue for somebody who didn't know anything about mental illness would probably be fears of violence, but they may be just something else completely, because our prejudices come about when we don't understand something very well. And those prejudices may be increased if you don't know anyone with mental illness and you read things in the newspaper, or you hear people speak in a stigmatizing way.
A physical illness and a mental illness are often treated differently due to the perceptions based on exhibited behaviors. And Backlar says that since behaviors associated with mental illness can often attract attention, people often feel uncomfortable.
We're very discriminatory about anything that is different, whether we look at it relevant to race or behavior. We all feel a little more comfortable when people are like us, whatever that us is.
The local campaign to address stigma and discrimination and mental illness launches on Thursday, April 27th at Portland State University. The symposium and workshop will include a keynote speech by Dr. Richard Warner, who helped direct the campaign for the World Psychiatric Association. Professor Backler adds that this local effort will use many of the approaches applied in the WPA program,
which we will customize the program that they have already had success with elsewhere, and to customize it to our needs here, relevant both to addiction and the other mental illnesses. And people may not be aware, but stigma and discrimination is greatest towards people with addictions and people and towards suicide.
For KBOO News, I'm Denise Kowalczyk.
A federal judge yesterday rebuffed the U.S. government's initial attempt to file a secret declaration in an Oregon lawsuit, challenging the legality of the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance program. Judge King gave federal officials until May 12th to provide a better argument. King said he might still consider looking at the secret filing in the future, but he is one of the few judges across the country to challenge government's attempts to discuss national security issues out of the presence of opposing attorneys. The lawsuit at issue was filed in late February by Al Haramain, an Ashland-based Islamic charity, and two of its attorneys. The suit claims that federal officials illegally intercepted telephone calls between an Al Haramain director and two attorneys based in Washington, D.C. Since the New York Times revealed the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program in December, several civil suits have been filed challenging the legality of the program. In addition, lawyers in a half a dozen criminal cases have asked for evidence obtained by warrantless wiretapping. Government officials have responded by filing secret responses not available to opposing counsel or the public. Judges have generally ruled in favor of the government without explaining why.
Oregon Tradeswomen is a nonprofit training program that prepares women for high-paid jobs in construction and contracting. The group holds its annual career fair this weekend. With us in Studio 2 is Executive Director Connie Ashbrook. Good evening, Connie.
Thank you, Noah. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, absolutely. So can you first tell us what is Oregon's Tradeswomen all about, and how many women do you serve?
Well, basically, we educate women and girls about these really cool careers in the building, construction, mechanical, and utility trades. And we help women get established in these careers. These are high-wage and high-skilled jobs that you can earn while you learn. We serve thousands of girls and almost 1,000 women each year.
So, Connie, what kind of jobs do your graduates qualify for, and also, why is it important to get more women into these kind of jobs?
Well, we graduated 75 women this year, and they are going into jobs like sheet metal worker, electrician, carpenter, steam fitter, and plumber. The reason why women want to get into these jobs is that these are really fun and cool careers. They're rewarding. You see the results of your labor. You get to be active, you get to make things happen, and of course there's good wages and benefits. So for instance, a sheet metal worker might start out at $14 an hour, and then after 5 years of on-the-job training plus classroom learning, they could make up to $28 an hour.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the values, you know, of teamwork, I believe, are really relevant in positions like this. So what will be happening at the career fair this weekend, and who are the exhibitioners?
So what will be happening will be all kinds of different hands-on workshops and exhibits. We have 70 different exhibitors, ranging from the iron workers apprenticeship, the sheet metal workers apprenticeship, the steam fitters, the plumbers. Mount Hood Community College will be there talking about their automotive mechanics program. TriMet will be there talking about their bus and rail mechanic program. So all kinds of jobs based on the trades and blue-collar work. And then there'll be chances to actually hands-on try out this kind of work. So tomorrow, Thursday, we'll have middle schoolers there from all over the metro region, as far away as the coast. On Friday, it's high school students and their teachers. And then on Saturday, it's open to the public. From 9 to 4, anybody is welcome to come, but we're really aimed at adult women who are unemployed or in dead-end jobs or are looking for a career change and want to try out these exciting jobs.
Amen to that. So if there are any listeners who can't make it this weekend, whether they want to bring their families to a picnic or something out in the nice woods, how else could they hook up with your organization?
We hold a free 7-week pre-apprenticeship training program 6 times a year. 7 weeks, you can get your head start to an excellent career in the trades. The next one will start June 20th, and then followed by one in August and one in October. So call us, job seekers. We look forward to hearing from you, and we look forward to seeing you at the fair.
And that's Connie Ashbrook sending the 401 out there. Thank you, Connie.
This weekend, Amnesty International USA hosts its annual conference on human rights in Portland. In anticipation of this event, the KBOO Evening News this week introduces you to the human rights defenders and abuse survivors working locally in Portland. For today's broadcast, reporter Kirsten Flagg spoke with the executive director of the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization.
Make an appointment and any other step forward is needed. Okay? If
Orientation to their new life here in the United States is just wrapping up here at ERCO, and the majority of the dozen or so recent immigrants look too exhausted to ask any questions. Sokum Touch, the organization's executive director, observes from the corner. It's been a long time since Touch was in a similar position, but his memories of bewilderment are still fresh.
I was a refugee from Cambodia in 1975, and you know, all I know about United States is Detroit making car. And I heard a song, I left my heart in San Francisco. You know, that's all I know about United States. And when I came here, it's an eye-opener. You know, I walking in downtown Portland Street, you know, people keep looking at you and then asking, should go back where you came from, you know, stuff like that. And they keep telling, go back to Japan. And I'm from Cambodia, you know. People just didn't know. Back in the 70s, people really doesn't know much about other country. And so I started to work for this organization, there were bombs threat, you know, and stuff like that. But somehow we are here 30 years already, and we done a good job, and I'm very proud to be associated with this organization.
Over the last 25 years, ERCO has shepherded 45,000 refugees and immigrants into the land of the automobile and rock and roll, helping with everything from employment to proper bus etiquette. Whereas an organization like Amnesty International fights to ensure that this country remains open to those fleeing war and oppression, ERCO stands inside this side of the fence and sees its fight for human rights from another angle.
Human right and us is pretty similar in terms, but human right is stop the abuse, you know. But for us here, it's trying to get them to forget all of that and then make a new life, living in a new ways in the United States. You have all kind of freedoms to do things. No one hunger of American dream like a refugee and immigrant, you know. They came here, they work very hard, so they can achieve American dream. The home ownership is astounding in refugee and immigrant community. You know, the ownership of the house is the sign of stability of their family. The city is their home. The community is their community.
Touch understands the toll of moving forward. He came to this country to escape the reign of the Khmer Rouge as a young man in 1975. Once here, he worked as a strawberry picker, a janitor, and for many years a translator and accountant with ERCO. His past followed him through all this, motivating him to help others.
A trauma that Cambodian has back home in the Khmer Rouge regime and stuff like that, and still carry forward in here. American who born here are very lucky they didn't see much of this. But other country, you know, life are not this good. And, you know, that's why refugee and immigrant love to come to United States, because life is different in here.
Touch says it's getting harder for refugees to come to the United States. He notes how services to the refugee camps that transfer people onto the U.S. have been cut back, meaning organizations like ERCO must shoulder more of the burden in orientating new arrivals. Also, he mentions that the organization rarely sees asylum seekers because of how difficult it is to receive this special status. Immigration legislation still being debated in Congress could add to the number of obstacles those fleeing the threat or reality of human rights abuse face in gaining lawful entry to the U.S. In one example, under proposed legislation, an asylum seeker caught in U.S. borders without documentation could be subject to criminal prosecution. With a criminal conviction, they then become ineligible for asylum.
I think being a superpower, United States need to still continue the admission of refugees. Don't make so tough on them, because these are people suffering from all kind of trauma in their life. Give them a chance to come here. Don't make it hard on them. You know, if you have a little more than you need, give them a share with them. You know, and they're going to be part of us.
To learn more about ERCO's work with immigrants and refugees, visit www.erco.org. I'm Kirsten Flagg, KBOO News.
This Friday at 4 p.m., Amnesty International hosts a rally at Pioneer Square to denounce torture. To hear more from our series on local human rights activists, visit the KBOO News Archives at www.kbu.fm.
And we'd like to take the moment really quickly here to apologize for all of you interested in attending the Oregon Tradeswomen Career Fair this weekend. If you'd like more information about exactly where it's taking place and when it is, it's going to be held this Saturday from 9 to 4 p.m. at the NECA IBEW Electrical Training Center, located at 16021 Northeast Airport Way in Portland. For more information on it, call 503-335-8200, extension 21. Or go to www.tradeswomen.net. And now on to our next story. Oregon nursing home patients should be getting better health care. That's a message from supporters of the new Nursing Home Residents Safety Act campaign launched yesterday. The effort would put an initiative on November's ballot to increase the number of nursing aides and staff to ensure quality care for patients. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside reports.
Oregon's over 60s crowd is booming, and that means a lot more business for the state's nursing homes. Over 3,000 Oregonians were admitted in 2004, the latest number is available. And a new ballot initiative campaign launched yesterday will bring attention to safety and care. The Nursing Home Resident Safety Act would increase the required number of nursing aides, assistants, and other staff. Verna Porter is a retired nurse and president of the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. She says current standards that allow one aide to care for 25 patients during the night aren't good for patients or staff.
Inadequate staffing is unsafe. The minimum is just not high enough.
The measure would also give the state authority to require regular audits and deny revoke licenses when nursing homes violate staffing standards. Critics say the additional staffing would increase nursing home costs. Verna Porter is a retired nurse and president of the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. She says in her experience, increasing staff and quality care pays off for everyone.
The facilities that had a reputation for good care and for safety, that had enough staff, they were always full and had a waiting list. The profit was there.
There are currently 142 licensed homes in the state. For KBOO News, I'm Sheila Whiteside reporting.
And now, time for another edition of KBOO's homegrown environmental series, Our Backyard, produced and hosted by our dear friend Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, coexisting in the environment and a puzzling decision by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that seems to contradict the concept of coexistence. In the excellent book, From Naked Ape to Super Species, authors David Suzuki and Holly Dressel point out that since Descartes, we have considered human intellect to be separate from and superior to the body. As we've become increasingly separated from nature in urban settings, we have come to believe that our intellect, manifested through science, empowers us with the capacity to understand and control the world around us. What they're talking about, of course, is scientific reductionism, the notion that nature is simply a mechanism to be controlled and kept at bay. An opposing view is represented by deep ecology, a phrase describing deep ecological awareness and the foundation of a branch of philosophy known as eco-philosophy that deals with the ethics of Gaia. The theoretical physicist Fritjof Capra defines deep ecology by contrasting it with shallow ecology. Shallow ecology, he says, is human-centered. It views humans as above or outside of nature, as the source of all value, and ascribes only instrumental or use value to nature. Deep ecology does not separate humans or anything else from the natural environment. Deep ecology sees the world not as a collection of isolated objects, but as a network of phenomena that are fundamentally interconnected and interdependent. Deep ecology recognizes the intrinsic value of all living beings and views human beings as just one particular strand in the web of life. And population ecologists speak of ecological footprints, the amount of land and water area a human population needs to provide the resources required to sustainably support itself and to absorb its wastes. As our ecological footprint increases, competition between species for the planet's resources intensifies.
And there are winners and there are losers. And the latest losers may be Oregon's cougars. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has approved a plan that will allow federal hunters to use dogs to track and kill cougars, a practice banned by Oregon voters since 1994. Brian Hines, the insightful and eloquent Willamette Valley blogger, says it plainly. These are not problem cougars that are threatening people or killing livestock. No, these are potential problem cougars. Cougars that are just hanging out, not bothering anybody. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife supports their argument this way. Cougars are an Oregon success story. After being nearly eliminated by the mid-1960s, today they have a healthy population. The current cougar population in Oregon is estimated to be 5,100. As both the cougar and human populations have grown, so have the number of conflicts and damage complaints. The Cougar Management Plan is designed to address this conflict by establishing a minimum desirable cougar population of at least 3,000. A respected ecological consulting firm that specializes in endangered species evaluations clearly deconstructs the logic the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife used in establishing this plan, pointing out that since 1990, our neighbor to the north, Washington, has recorded 8 cougar attacks, and our southern neighbor, California, has recorded only 7. During this same period, no verified attacks have been documented in Oregon. But this isn't about numbers, really. It's about sharing our space with another species. The Oregon Department of Wildlife and Fish plan is now approved, even though virtually all who testified in public forums opposed it, including the Predator Defense League, Sport Hunters, and even the NRA. At some point, we must each decide whether our relationship with other species on the planet is one of coexistence or competition. Might be a question worth asking some of those folks running for public office this year. In the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
Time is 5:29. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News. 3 groups are challenging the Forest Service plans for logging and other activities in Montana's Bitterroot Valley. Former Fox News anchor Tony Snow has been named the new White House press secretary. And the Oxford English Dictionary reached an epic milestone today, hitting a total of 1 billion words. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
We didn't have much time. Friends, Papa, and the mothers were at the best place around. Some stupid with a flag on burned the place to the ground. Smoke on the water, fire in the sky.
Karl Rove may face imminent indictment. Investigative reporter Jason Leopold, writing today in truthout.org, says Rove's appearance before a grand jury in the CIA leak case today comes on the heels of a target letter sent to his attorney recently by Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, indicating that there may be substantial evidence linking him to a crime. Sources close to the 2-year-old leak investigation said that when Rove's attorney received the letter, Rove volunteered to appear before the grand jury for an unprecedented 5th time. Rove is expected to explain why he did not previously disclose conversations he had with the media about covert CIA operative Valerie Plame and her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who criticized the Bush's administration's use of pre-war Iraq intelligence. A federal grand jury target letter is sent to a person in criminal investigation who is likely to be indicted. In a prepared statement today, Fitzgerald indicated that Rove is not a target of the investigation.
Later, sharply criticized soaring gasoline prices and energy industry profits, GOP negotiators have decided to knock out provisions in a major tax bill that would force the oil companies to pay billions of dollars more in taxes on their profits. House and Senate tax writers have been struggling to reach an accord on separate tax bills approved last year to extend some expiring tax cuts enacted during President Bush's first term. But House Republicans have raised strong objections to Senate-passed provisions that would raise nearly $5 billion in taxes over 5 years, primarily by changing accounting rules that would have allowed oil companies to substantially lower their tax bills, according to House and Senate tax aides familiar with the talks. Observers say the actions of Republicans hashing out a tax bill behind closed doors indicate that, despite tough talk from the White House and Capitol Hill, the party is not ready to hit the oil companies hard, even on measures that have broad support in the Senate.
Rally organized by one of the country's newest labor movements. The main topic was the continuing problems Walmart employees have over decent health care coverage. KBOO's Doug Guidi has the story.
Various members of Portland's union movement, both new and old, were in full force in Pioneer Courthouse Square to inform people on how Walmart continues to feed off the American taxpayer by offering little or no medical coverage. The rally, Help Cure the Walmart Healthcare Crisis, was sponsored by the newly formed Change the Wind Coalition, a new player in America's labor force. Portland was just one city amongst 35 other cities that hosted rallies to center in on the poor benefits multi-billion dollar Walmart provides. Geraldine Luddy is vice president of the UFCW and a national representative of the Change the Wind Coalition. She was one of the speakers at downtown's rally.
There's something wrong in America when Walmart workers are forced to rely on public assistance and Medicaid to provide their children health insurance. When the welfare kids are worth $19 billion each, there is something wrong in America. And there's something wrong in America when immigrant workers are exploited, locked into the workplaces overnight, and then they are criminalized. There is something wrong in America when workers are simply trying to put food on the table and they become criminals. Something wrong.
Walmart fails to provide company health care to 57% of its employees. Of its 1.3 million employees, leaving nearly one out of two children of Walmart workers uninsured or on public health care at a cost to American taxpayers of about $1.4 billion every year. Much of the assistance in informing the American public on Walmart's poor health care benefits comes from grassroots supporters of Wake Up Walmart, a group that has been making lots of news, even in mainstream media outlets. The group's campaign movement claims to have over 211,000 supporters and is growing. Jeremy Bird is a regional representative of Wake Up Walmart and arrived from a national gathering in Washington, D.C.
The Change the Wind movement across the country, the Wake Up Walmart campaign, are making a difference in this company. In three of the last 4 months, fewer people have walked into a Walmart store than did the same month the year before. That had never happened in the company's history. A poll taken last December showed that 56% of Americans now believe that Walmart is bad for America. That, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, is a 30% change in 7 months because of the work that we're all doing.
But much help comes from the newly formed Change the Wind Coalition, which includes unions dissatisfied with the way union giant the AFL-CIO was working. Change the Wind unions include the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, the Service Employees International Union, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, Unite Here, Laborers International Union of North America, and the United Farm Workers of America. Kay is a union member of the UFCW Local 55 and attended the rally.
Well, we care about the employees inside, and that's what we're about, is the working family. That's what UFCW stands for, and if we can assist employees inside in any way, then we're going to do it. And if it takes a rally every day, we're here for them, too. So we need to know that they're getting affordable health care, too.
The Wake Up Walmart movement is growing by leaps and bounds across the U.S., educating Americans of the insufficient health care Walmart provides. Thanks to Change the Wind and other union groups, change is on the horizon. For KBOO News, I'm Doug Guidi.
Tony Snow, a former conservative pundit for Fox News, has been named White House press secretary. He replaces Scott McClellan, who resigned in a personal shuffle intended to re-energize the White House staff. Snow has been the host of the Tony Snow Show on Fox News Radio and Weekend Live with Tony Snow on the Fox News Channel. Under the first Bush administration, he was a speechwriting director and later a deputy assistant to the president for media affairs. Snow has already left his position on Fox News Radio and is scheduled to begin his job May 8, though he may not appear as spokesperson for the White House immediately.
Logging, burning, and other work that the Forest Service has planned in Montana's Bitterroot Valley is being challenged in a lawsuit filed today in federal court. Three groups say the agency plans environmentally risky work under the guise of improving forest health and reducing fuels for wildfires. The project would be on nearly 5,000 acres in the Bitterroot National Forest. In 2000, fires there burned more than 300,000 acres. 70 homes in the Bitterroot Valley burned. The lawsuit was filed by the Ecology Center, Friends of the Bitterroot, and the Native Forest Network. They say the work should be blocked because it threatens wildlife habitat, soils, and watersheds. Named as defendants are the Forest Service, its regional forester, and the Bitterroot National Forest Supervisor. A spokeswoman for the Bitterroot Forest declined to comment on the lawsuit.
The current time is 5:37, and now time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We all remember George W.'s fleeting moment of glory 3 years ago when he strutted aboard that aircraft carrier under a banner that shouted, "Mission accomplished." Well, 3 years, $300 billion, and 2,300 American deaths later, Bush's mission is a quagmire with no end in sight. But he was not the only one gloating back then. Right-wing media pundits who had been enthusiastic long-distance cheerleaders of George's magnificent adventure in Iraq were also full of themselves. Before we let these geniuses side with Bush again to get us into a new war with Iran, let's play back some of their insights from the early days of the Iraq War. "The war was the hard part," beamed a gleeful Fred Barnes on Fox News. "And it gets easier. I mean, setting up a democracy is hard, but not as hard as winning a war." MSNBC's Chris Matthews razzed Howard Dean for being an anti-war candidate, saying, "What's he going to talk about a year from now? The fact that the war went too well and it's over?" And here's a keen observation from Fox News' Dick Morris. "Over the next couple of weeks, when we find the chemical weapons this guy was amassing, I think really means that the left is going to hang its head for 3 or 4 years." Of course, Bill Blowhard O'Reilly is a brilliant judge of what war involves, offering this slightly off-target prediction in 03. "I will bet you the best dinner in the Gaslight District of San Diego that military action will not last more than a week." Let's go back to Chris Matthews for the final word. "Americans love having a guy as president, a guy who has a little swagger. Women like a guy who's president. Check it out. The women like this war. I think we like having a hero as our president. It's simple." This is Jim Hightower saying, no, Bush is simple. War is hell. And it's always more complex than it looks from an air-conditioned television studio. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, The Underground. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy, lows 40 to 45. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy again in the morning, but then partly sunny, highs around 70. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Just days after U.S. troops were ordered to plug a security breach at their Afghanistan base, the black market trade in computer memory drives containing military documents was thriving again Monday. Traders at the bazaar near Bagram's main gate were openly displayed pilfered U.S. military memory drives in their shops Monday, 2 weeks after the Los Angeles Times reported on the black market in computer equipment, some of which contained American military documents marked secret. Documents on flash drives for sale at a bazaar across from the American military base over the weekend contain U.S. officers' names and cell phone numbers and instructions on using pain to control prisoners who put up resistance. U.S. soldiers spent thousands of dollars 2 weeks ago buying scores of flash memory drives from the bazaar. The soldiers walked through the black market with a box of money, purchasing all the computer equipment they could find. For several days afterward, no more memory drives were available. But an 18-year-old Afghan man who works on the base said that by Friday, memory drives were being smuggled off the base again.
The Sri Lankan military today launched new strikes on areas controlled by Tamil Tiger rebels, a day after a suicide bomb attack shattered a fragile ceasefire. Puniya Manika Vasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
The military spokesman Brigadier Prasad Samarasinghe said the strikes came after the Liberation Tigers of Tamililam or the LTT fired on naval patrol craft off the eastern port of Trincomalee for a second day. Tuesday's attack carried out by a female suicide bomber at the army headquarters in the capital Colombo killed 9 people and seriously wounded Sri Lankan army commander Lieutenant General Sarath Fonseca and over 24 others. The government blamed the Tamil Tigers for the attack. The rebels have denied the charges. A rebel leader in the eastern part of the island nation told reporters that today's air attacks by the government forces killed 12 and forced 15,000 people to flee the area for safety. The government said the strikes would last as long as the Tigers continue their attacks. The head of the rebels' peace secretariat told news agencies the Tamil Tigers will be forced to take military defensive action. Wolf Hendrickson, the head of the monitoring team, said the truce in Sri Lanka is still valid on paper, but both parties have seriously violated the agreement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Year anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And two new reports indicate that tens of thousands of people will likely die of various cancers caused by radiation from the Chernobyl explosion. When the Soviet-era Chernobyl reactor blew in 1986, it blasted 200 times the combined radiation of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atom bombs into the environment. Fallout from the disaster drifted not only over parts of the former Soviet Union, but throughout Eastern Europe, the UK, and the Eastern United States. FSRN's Danuta Savranenzik has more from Warsaw.
As of mid-2005, fewer than 50 deaths had been directly attributed to radiation from the disaster, almost all being highly exposed rescue workers, many who died within months of the accident, but others who died as late as 2004. The latest UN report, however, speaks of up to 4,000 people that could eventually die of radiation exposure and cancer induced as a result of it. 2 days after the fallout, obligatory application of stable iodine was administered, reaching 18.5 million Poles. Dr. Andrzej Komosa works at the radiochemistry department at the Maria Skłodowska University in Lublin, eastern Poland, where contamination tests were conducted just hours after the explosion on April 26, 1986.
I remember very well this date because it was the first time I have contact with such large amount of isotopes. Chernobyl contamination was known to reveal hot particles, parts of reactor core. It contained very large amount of radioisotopes as a product of fission reaction and fissible material like uranium or plutonium.
The statistics are often contradictory due to the fact that there were so many people involved in it, including 800,000 liquidators helping on the reactor site and around 40,000 people living in Chernobyl at that time. It is also difficult to specify how much of the reactor core came into the atmosphere. Hence, the lower limit on the number of victims is 4,000, while the upper estimates go up to 60,000 deaths. Professor Zbigniew Jaworowski, a former chairman of the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, plays down the heaviness of such data.
My impression is that during last year or two, this wave of real lies about Chernobyl decreased dramatically. Now we are confronted with more sober, although not quite correct, information. We know that, in fact, the medical effects of Chernobyl were caused by the extremely high doses received by the people working in the nuclear power station and in the members of the rescue teams. Altogether, due to those extremely high doses, 28 people died after being irradiated.
In spite of the relatively low number of casualties in the Chernobyl blast, environmental activists argue that no one can deny it emitted a huge amount of radioactivity into the atmosphere and resulted in a massive disruption of life throughout Europe. Jan Haverkamp, nuclear energy consultant for Greenpeace, also points to the necessity of seeking alternative sources of energy.
The question is, if there are alternatives, should we use it? And the alternatives are there. You know, I think we are indebted to the victims that we look very carefully to the alternatives. And I think in the fast discussion, which is now happening under the threat from Moscow to use the gas tap in a political way, some lobbyists see a chance to overstep that careful looking to the alternatives. They say, we should have nuclear power. That's the only solution we can find. I say, please open your eyes, also for Poland. You don't need nuclear power.
While speculation over the real impact of Chernobyl continues, the fact remains that 20 years after the blast, there are still hotspots in Europe. One is in Lapland, where reindeer meat often has to be destroyed because it contains high level of cesium. Another is in Scotland, where in one area, sheep still cannot be bred for meat. There may be many more, as these hotspots are still difficult to trace. I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, Warsaw.
Canada has now banned reporters from witnessing the return of the coffins of Canadian soldiers. Alison Benjamin reports from Vancouver.
Canada's conservative government took steps yesterday to keep the public from seeing images of flag-draped coffins containing Canadian soldiers killed in Afghanistan. The media was banned Tuesday from the CFB Trenton base as the bodies of Corporal Matthew Dinning, Bombardier Miles Mansell, Lieutenant William Turner, and Corporal Randy Payne returned home. The four soldiers were killed in an explosion Saturday. Defense Minister Gordon O'Connor has indicated that the media ban will apply to future deaths of Canadian soldiers. Prime Minister Harper says opponents of the policy are politicizing the issue and says that the media ban protects military families. The new media ban is similar to one already in place in the U.S. For FSRN in Vancouver, I'm Alison Benjamin.
The United Nations Nuclear Authority is to launch a cleanup operation to protect 1,000 people living around a bomb former nuclear complex south of Baghdad, who they say are at acute risk of radioactive poisoning. The International Atomic Energy Agency said that levels of radiation at the Tuwaitha plant, once the center of Saddam Hussein's nuclear program, are known to be higher than normal. But Tuwaitha complex was thoroughly investigated and largely dismantled during UN inspections in the 1990s. However, the Americans, following their invasion and occupation in 2003, came under severe criticism for failing to secure the complex and standing by while it was looted.
As the Iraqi government remains in a transitory state, those that stand to lose the most are the thousands of Iraqis in prisons around the country. Torture continues in some Iraqi facilities, making the families of prisoners even more apprehensive. FSRN's David Enders is in Baghdad and files this report.
At the Ministry of Human Rights Prisoner Tracking Department, tears flow freely. On Monday, Jamila Abdullah Hikmet was looking for her brother, Jamil Abdullah Hikmet, who was arrested from his home on December 25th. With thousands of Iraqis kidnapped and arrested in the last 3 years, often in murky circumstances, the Ministry of Human Rights has become one more place Iraqis come to look for missing relatives. More than 34,000 Iraqis are held at one of the dozens of prisons across the country run by either the U.S. military or the Iraqi Ministries of Interior, Defense, and Justice. The system has become more organized in recent months, but prisoners are still lost. Hikmet said she visited morgues first, believing initially that her brother had been taken by men only posing as government officials. Hikmet said she then visited dozens of prisons before she was told by an official at the Ministry of Interior that Jamil was being held by the Wolf Brigade, one of the ministry's elite police units. She was then sent to the Ministry of Human Rights, which tracks prisoners centrally. It has been 2 weeks, but the Human Rights Office can still not confirm that the Interior Ministry is holding her brother.
We keep searching for him, but we still don't know where he is.
Even for prisoners who can be located, families often face confusing circumstances and long waits before legal proceedings take place. As the U.S. military has tried to turn over more responsibilities to the Iraqi government since 2004, some prisoners have been transferred multiple times. Under current Iraqi law, it is illegal for anybody but the Ministry of Justice to operate prisons, but officials working in the Ministry of Justice say they are not receiving new facilities quickly enough to accommodate the thousands of prisoners in various custodies, some of whom have been held for more than a year without charges. Jemma Hussein, the general in charge of the ministry's prisons, says that the Justice Department has been up and running for more than 2 years, but only two new prisons are under construction, and that those can only hold 1,600 prisoners total.
The number of prisoners is growing, and the Ministry of Interior is putting pressure on us to take more prisoners, but we don't have enough space. If more prisons are not built, maybe there will be more human rights violations in the future.
Juma said the U.S. military is training his men to take over Camp Buka, which presently holds nearly 7,000 prisoners, as soon as 6 months from now. The Justice Ministry took over the hard site at Abu Ghraib last year, though the U.S. military maintains an outdoor prison facility. The U.S. military has also begun transferring prisoners to Fort Sousse, a recently opened prison near Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan, in preparation for shutting down U.S. operations at Abu Ghraib entirely. Families of prisoners and Iraqi human rights groups have also complained recently that it is hard for Arab families to visit their relatives in Sousse because of discrimination against them by Kurdish security forces, and Arab Sunnis have complained that the trip to Buka, near Basra, has become increasingly dangerous because of the risk of being arrested by largely Shiite security forces while traveling in the south. Saad Sultan, who is in charge of the Ministry of Human Rights Prisoner Tracking Department, says that the moving of prisoners from Abu Ghraib prison, near Baghdad, to locations in the north and south was a direct result of the impossibility of keeping prisoners safe in restive central Iraq. At least 35 prisoners have been killed by insurgent mortar strikes at Abu Ghraib since 2003, and dozens more injured.
If you miss the prison in the hot area, you will make all the families in very dangerous situation. Right. If you put the prison in safe place, you will say it is very difficult to transfer. That means we need to build small prison for everyone beside his home.
In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Research database responsible for bringing words such as podcast to the pages of the Oxford dictionaries has officially hit a total of 1 billion words. Drawing on sources such as weblogs, chat rooms, newspapers, magazines, and fiction, the Oxford English Corpus spots emerging trends in language usage to help guide lexicographers when composing the most recent editions of dictionaries. The press publishes the Oxford English Dictionary, considered the most comprehensive dictionary of the language, which is its most recent August 2005 edition added words such as supersize, wiki, and retail politics to its pages. As hybrid words such as geek chick, inner child, or gavfest increase in usage, part of the research project's goal is to identify words that have lasting power. It has helped identify such the spellings of common phrases have changed, such as phase by to phase by, or free reign to free reign, while buck naked increasingly has evolved to butt naked. The corpus collects evidence from all the places where English is spoken, whether from North America, Britain, the Caribbean, Australia, or India, to reflect the most current and common usage of the English language.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 26, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032.